If you would, turn to Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12. We'll start there this morning in a moment. It's really good to be together this morning, both those of us in person and those of us who are watching online. We're thinking of you as well. Two confessions, I guess, as we start. Number one, I suppose I've been preaching in some capacity for about 5 years, and one of my self-imposed rules is that 30 minutes of me monologuing is more than enough. But I think this morning I'll go over by about a minute or two, so I wanted to be honest about that. And number two, I have a lot of work to do when it comes to studying and understanding the book of Romans. And though we're going to start there this morning, I'm far from a Roman scholar, and I pray you'd bear with me there. But in Romans 12, verse 1, Paul, an apostle of God, writes this: "I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship." Paul is appealing to the Christians in Rome here. I think the idea is that he's actually begging them. I know a little bit about begging. We've been begging Silas to stay in his bed night after night after night, and it's a desperate appeal. And I think Paul, on a more deep life-defining level, is desperately appealing that they, and of course we, Christians today, would present our bodies as a living sacrifice to God. It's a big ask. And so Paul has built to that ask in what we call the last three chapters of his letter to the Romans, sharing why they should offer themselves to God in this way. The church in Rome was made up of people with different backgrounds. There were Jews, God's people of old, and there were Gentiles, pagans who had more recently come to serve the God of the Bible. And Paul says that the Jews were adopted by God and given this amazing covenant, and the Savior of the world even came through their people. And so you might consider some of the national pride that they might have brought to that congregation with them. I really kind of hate the sport of soccer, but I liked the World Cup a lot. And I liked it because when I was in Boston, people would come together to watch the games, and they would bring their jerseys, and they'd bring a lot of joy, and they'd bring a lot of national pride. I heard that Maria wore her Spain jersey the night of the study, or the night when the championship game was, and I wish I was here for that too. You know, the Jews likely would have had a sense of national pride. But the Jews failed in their service to God, Paul says. Not because of God's words not being good enough or his promises not getting the job done. No, it's because they relied on righteousness by law and not by faith. But God did not totally reject the Jews. He was very merciful to them, and Paul himself is evidence of that, as he is a Jew. And then Paul says of the Gentiles, they had been given this amazing chance to be part of this family of God as well, to be among God's people and to receive salvation. And in chapter 10, Paul says two really powerful things building to chapter 12. He says in verse 11 of chapter 10, "Everyone who believes in him, who believes in Jesus, will not be put to shame." And in verse 13, "Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved." So, because of what God has done, present your bodies as a living sacrifice to him. This is the way you worship him for what he did for you. The idea of presenting is the idea of providing or yielding your body. And the idea of the word bodies there, I believe, really brings two components into play, the physical and the spiritual. That it's not just an intellectual or a spiritual commitment we're called to make. No, it's a very physical one as well. That our souls are inhabiting these bodies temporarily, and we can dedicate these physical bodies in sacrificial service to God. And Paul calls us to be a sacrifice that is living, therefore not dead. But not just not dead, not even lifeless, you know? The idea or the word picture there is we're to be a sacrifice that is full of life and vigor and even action. When you think of a sacrifice, what comes to your mind? What kinds of things come to your mind? Maybe you think about the literal burning of a body and that kind of sacrifice. Maybe you think more generally of the idea of giving something up for the sake of someone or something else. Romans isn't the only place we see Christians being called to make sacrifices. In 1 Peter, it says that God is building his people up into a spiritual house, a priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices. The Hebrew writer calls Christians to continually offer a sacrifice of praise to God. I think that sacrifice is part of the world around us. It's really embedded into the fabric. It's everywhere. And it takes a lot of different forms. For one thing, millions of people still participate in some form of animal sacrifice ritual, even today, in their attempt to connect with God or the gods, little g. Often, many people will make a journey to make that sacrifice at great cost to themselves. And as you look back at different cultures, Greek culture, Norse culture, altar after altar has been unearthed through archaeology, showing that people had been making animal sacrifices for a really long time. And of course, God's people themselves participated in animal sacrifice for many years, with over 400 references to altars in the Bible. But there are other forms of sacrifice happening everywhere that embody the idea of giving something up for the sake of something else. I think one place you see it is in the animal kingdom. I'll give you an example if that's okay. I don't know if you were thinking about the deep sea octopus this morning, but the deep sea octopus broods her eggs for 4.5 years. She puts all of her energy into blowing clean oxygenated water over those eggs while hooking herself onto this rock cave to keep them safe. Somehow, for 4.5 years, she doesn't even eat during that process. And when they finally hatch, she passes away, sacrificing herself to bring them life. You can look it up, not right now, but after. I will say it's a pretty creepily ugly animal, so I'll warn you, but an example of sacrifice. And of course, sacrifice is in various cultures throughout history that hold up and honor those who sacrifice give the ultimate sacrifice, giving themselves for the sake of somebody else. Even in a sports sense, maybe me and others in this room in a few months are going to honor those people who give up their body to carry a leather ball into the end zone. You may have heard quotes like, "True success requires sacrifice," or "Let us sacrifice today so that our children can have a better tomorrow." You know, no matter who you are or what you believe in this morning, I think the truth is that you are sacrificing to something. You're offering yourself up to someone or something. And maybe you've been offering yourself to things down here in this world, the gods of the flesh, the gods of this world in some way or another. Maybe you've been offering yourself to God as best you can. Or maybe you're struggling somewhere in the in-between. But this morning, I'd like us to think about really three things. What we're sacrificing to, what those sacrifices look like, and perhaps what they should look like. I think sometimes we give ourselves up to things that are inherently ungodly, indulging in things in this world that please us and not the God that created us. I think about my past and know that I've done that. Giving myself to things like sexual immorality and drunkenness and drugs, or just sometimes we give ourselves up to entertainment that just distracts us and pulls us into this world and away from God. But I think sometimes we give ourselves up to things that are actually good, but we put them in the place of God, which just doesn't work either, you know? We might give ourselves fully to our careers or to gaining some sort of secular wisdom or to relationships at the expense of our relationship with God. There's a book I love, and the writer wrote about people who had died, and then they're in some sort of kind of made-up purgatory or hellish state. And they're there because in life they sacrifice to things other than to God. But in this made-up world, they have this opportunity to get out of there, to make it to heaven, if they just get on this bus and ride out of hell. And so some of them do that. They go and interact with people from this heavenly country. And the people try to convince them to go with them further into heaven. And there's this one woman who had a son, And in life, she gave everything for him. You know, he was her life. And she's really annoyed at the idea of religion, but she'll do anything to see her son who is in heaven. So she gets on this bus and goes to see him. And in life, her son had passed away before she did. And so she was bitter. She was frustrated towards God for taking him. I can only imagine the pain she would have felt, of course. But when the bus drops her off and she's talking with a heavenly being, she learns that God took her son away and brought him to himself. And God did it in an effort to turn her away from the all-encompassing love that she felt for her son, hoping that she would fall in love totally with his son. See, her maternal love, such a positive, God-given thing, had turned fierce and uncontrollable and all-consuming. She'd sacrificed herself to her son, and maternal love had been replaced by any hope of true godly love. And that's just a story, but there's a lot of ways that can happen, where we twist good gifts of God into things that we offer our lives to completely. You know, for God's people of old, sacrificing was a really big part of their lives. There were different types of animal sacrifices that they were commanded to take part in. Turn to Leviticus 4, if you will, or you can look up on the overhead. Leviticus 4. In the first five chapters of the book of Leviticus, there are different examples of offerings the people would make to God. And in chapter 4, we learn about sin offerings. The text says this, chapter 4, verse 27. If any one of the common people sins unintentionally in doing any one of the things that by the Lord's commandments ought not to be done, and realizes his guilt, or the sin which he has committed is made known to him, he shall bring for his offering a goat, a female without blemish, for his sin which he has committed. And he shall lay his hand on the head of the sin offering and kill the sin offering in the place of the burnt offering. So imagine that you were one of God's people during that time and you've committed a sin. And if you care about your relationship with God, the picture of sacrifice here is that in order to be restored, you'd bring an offering. That makes sense, I guess, because the definition of an offering is to go up or ascend. It's a means of reconnecting with the Most High God. And so first, you'd go into your herd of animals, if you had one, your livelihood, and you'd pick the very best one, one without blemish. And the picture, of course, is that you're giving up something incredibly costly to God. You're giving your very best. By the way, it would make sense that the Israelites would have wanted to give their best to God. He'd rescued them from slavery and given them life and given them a home. And I bet many of you are just like me. You want to give your very best in various parts of your lives. You want to give your best to your spouse, if you have one, to your children or your grandchildren, maybe to your jobs, maybe to your community. Yet sometimes we don't give our very best to God, who has rescued us and given us a home and given us a life. But imagine you're giving up this animal that you've cared for and that's been providing for your family, and then you've got to bring it to the altar. And so you get in line, because there's a lot of Israelites who are doing the same things, and you can imagine getting closer to the altar, closer to the stench that would come with burning flesh, closer to the point where death is occurring. And you can imagine starting to see the blood that would have been there at the altar. And then, as verse 29 says, you finally grab a knife and take the life of your animal. You make a sacrifice. You know, what a connection it would have been between the sacrifice, between God, and the one bringing the sacrifice in this process. Paul says in Romans 12 that the Christian's offering of a living sacrifice has the goal of being acceptable to the Lord. And here you get the idea of acceptable in the fact that in verse 31, it's a pleasing aroma to the Lord. And so it leads to forgiveness. I'm not so sure it would have been a literally good smell, you know, that kind of stench that was going up. But it's a pleasing aroma, no doubt, because it's made in accordance with God's will. Well, as time went on, another Israelite, King David, talks about sacrifice. In Psalm 51, Psalm 51, David is writing after struggling with sexual immorality. He's taken another man's wife, and I suppose he's asking God to forgive him and cleanse him of that. And he says this of God in verse 16 of Psalm 51. He says, "For you will not delight in sacrifice, or I would give it. You will not be pleased with a burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. Do good to Zion in your good pleasure. Build up the walls of Jerusalem. Then you will delight in right sacrifices, in burnt offerings, and whole burnt offerings. Then bulls will be offered on your altar." I think David here is connecting two components of sacrifice at that time. The offerer's broken spirit and contrite heart, and physically offering animal sacrifices. In a way, David is offering himself as a living sacrifice. And I think he's also highlighting the difficulty of being a living sacrifice, which, as I heard, I think my sister-in-law say, is that a living sacrifice keeps trying to crawl off the altar. And that's what David did with Bathsheba, and that's what we do when we try to offer ourselves, but then we do what we want to do at different times. But it's another moment in the life of David that I want to think about primarily, and that's in 2 Samuel 24. 2 Samuel 24. We'll turn there in just a moment, but right before the moment we're going to talk about in 2 Samuel 24, both in Samuel's and the chronicler's accounts, there are various victories that God had given his people with David as their king. They're riding a high. But then David decides to number the men of war, to have a census. And I think there's a lot we can say about why David did that. But one thing is clear. God did not condone it. And you can imagine the census back then would have taken a really long time because they would have had to go from town to town to town. He had time to stop and fix that mistake along the way, but he didn't, which I can relate to. I think of times in my own life when I've been doing the wrong thing for a long period, and I've had a time, a chance to come back to God, and I don't, you know, for that extended period. I'm thankful for the patience that God has given me during those times. And if you're in one of those periods right now, come back to him. He wants to have you back. But in 2 Samuel 24, verse 10, it says, "David's heart struck him after he had numbered the people. And David said to the Lord, 'I have sinned greatly in what I have done.'" And as a result, the Lord sends a pestilence. I had to Google that word. You may know it. But it's likely a fast-spreading disease or epidemic, maybe something like COVID. I don't know. But the Lord sends this on Israel, and people are dying rapidly to the tune of, I think, 70,000 men. And so a prophet comes and says to David, "David, you got to go. You got to go and make an altar and make a sacrifice and do it at the threshing floor of this guy named Araunah." Here's what the text says in 2 Samuel 24:20. 2 Samuel 24:20. "And when Araunah looked down, he saw the king and his servants coming toward him. And Araunah went and paid homage to the king with his face to the ground. And Araunah said, 'Why has my lord the king come to his servant?' David said, 'To buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be averted from the people.' Then Araunah said to David, 'Let my lord the king take and offer up what seems good to him. Here are the oxen for the burnt offering and the threshing sledges and the yokes of the oxen for the wood. All this, O king,' Araunah gives to the king. And Araunah said to the king, 'May the Lord your God accept you.' But the king said to Araunah, 'No, but I will buy it from you for a price. I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God that cost me nothing.'" I think this is a really hard statement that David makes. I've kind of been chewing on it for the past 5 years since I read it. But David makes the point that a sacrifice that costs nothing, it's not a sacrifice at all. And maybe you're here this morning, and as you think about the way that you've been living and what you've been doing, you know you've been giving yourselves to things other than to God. Maybe you being here this morning is a step towards him and wanting to live for him. Or maybe you're already a Christian. You've been giving yourself to God for some time. Either way, I'd ask, are you making sacrifices that cost you nothing? Am I doing that? Because if so, we're not the living sacrifice that God, through Paul, is calling us to be. Serving God and dedicating our lives to God inherently comes at a cost. Giving ourselves to God will come at the expense of other things on this earth. But the things we give up are far outshone by the things that we receive from God. I think it's certainly true eternally, but I believe even in the here and now, that is true. In fact, perhaps the things that we give up will seem as nothing from the view of eternity, you know? I love what the psalmist says in Psalm 84:10. He says, I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of the wickedness. And that's a time when tents were like where you want to be a little bit, I guess. But one person also said it's only through surrender that we can experience God's greatest blessings. And while we've talked about a few moments of sacrifice, being a living sacrifice, it's not a single event. It's not a moment. It's a lifestyle. Our last text will be in Hebrews 13. Hebrews 13. The Hebrew writer asks us to continually offer a sacrifice of praise to God through Jesus. But first, the writer details the cost that was paid to make it possible for us to do that. Hebrews 13, verses 10 through 12. Hebrews 13, 10 through 12. We have an altar from which those who serve the tent have no right to eat. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy places by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin are burned outside the camp. So Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Our offering is different from Israel's in that we don't offer an animal-based offering for our sins. The sacrifices we make, they're not for forgiveness. That's what Jesus' sacrifice is for. The basis of sacrificing our bodies to God is rather to give thanks for what he has done and to consecrate ourselves to his service. And the cost God paid so that he could have a relationship with me and with you was his only son. I was thinking about how God treats his sons and daughters, of course, throughout history. Adam is called the son of God in Luke's gospel. And we know Adam sinned. Adam made a mistake in the garden, breaking God's law. But it's God that made Adam a garment of animal skin to cover his shame. And God calls the nation of Israel his firstborn son in Exodus. And they sin over and over, breaking God's law. And he rescues them over and over again. And in one of my favorite stories, the story of the prodigal son, we see the picture of how God treats his sons even now. That when the prodigal finally realizes how bankrupt he is without the father, and he decides to go back, it seems like he starts to think to himself, what am I going to say when I finally get back that the father will actually accept me? And so he comes up with this speech. He's going to say, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. Maybe on the way back to see his father, he rehearsed it over and over. You probably had a time when you have a big speech coming up or an important conversation. Maybe that's what he was doing on his way back. But as he approaches his father, before he can even get a word out, his father runs and embraces him. And then the son finally gets to start his speech, but the father really wants none of it. Instead, he says, bring quickly the best robe, put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. For this my son was dead and is alive again. This is how God treats his sons and his daughters. Yet, God did to his only begotten son, to Jesus, what he doesn't do to his other sons. He let his only son suffer and die as a sacrifice for all his other sons. That Jesus went outside the gate, as the Hebrew writer says, where death and carcasses belonged, so that we could be with God inside the gate. That Jesus offered himself as a sacrifice, so that we could offer ourselves as a sacrifice as well. What a cost God has paid. Yet once again, are we offering sacrifices that cost us nothing in return? How badly do we want to serve the Lord? You know, when you came here, you made a sacrifice. You chose to reject doing other things this morning for the sake of worshiping God. When I asked Mel to marry me, I was rejecting all other women. You know, kind of a sad thing for them. No, I'm just kidding. I'm very difficult to live with. But I was rejecting other women. When we choose to offer ourselves to God, we inherently reject offering ourselves to certain other things. And when we truly value a relationship with God, there's nothing we want to hold back, nothing we won't reject for Him. Paul begs you and me to dedicate our whole lives to God because of what God has done for us, to be transformed from this world, not conformed to it. He asks us to trade what's worthless in this world for what's infinitely valuable in Him, in Jesus. You know, our living sacrifice, it's far from perfect. But that's okay because Jesus's was perfect. And I wonder if the way that we can be an acceptable offering to God is not by fixing our eyes on our own sacrifice, but rather solely on Jesus's. That's what the Hebrew writer says, that we run with endurance the race set before us, looking to Jesus, fixing our eyes on Jesus. That it may be no longer we who live, but Christ living in us, in every part of us. That by focusing on Jesus, the pinnacle of God's mercy and grace, we can be transformed from, rather than conformed to, the world around us. It's the mercy of God, the grace of God, that is the motive for our commitment, our sacrifice. As we close, I wanted to briefly share a few things the Hebrew writer says some components of a true living sacrifice are. In Hebrews 13, 15 through 16, three things are named. It says, through Him, through Jesus, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of lips that acknowledge His name. Do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God. The Hebrew writer mentions three things here. One, we need to have lips that acknowledge who God is, what He has done, and what He is doing. We need to speak about His name. We need to share His name. We need to represent His name. We need to tell of His deeds in songs of joy, as the psalmist says. We need to share what He's done for us. We need to do good. We need to be busy working hard and doing good, making costly offerings to others on God's behalf. And we need to share what we have. We need to give to others what God has given to us. You know, those things remind me of one of the offerings that the Israelites would make, called a peace offering. Unlike the other offerings, the peace offering was a voluntary offering. I believe it's the only offering as well that you would actually eat the meat of the offering and share it with others as well in a fellowship sort of way. That's what we're called to make, a voluntary offering of ourselves because of the peace that Jesus brought us through the cross. Our offering is meant to be shared with others that they may come to know the God that we're living for as well. As you look back on that day when David numbered the people and so many were killed as a result of his sin, it had to be a tough day. Death reigned supreme that day. And the prophet told David to go up, go to this higher place and make a sacrifice there to God. It'd be in that same exact place that the temple of God would later be built, and more sacrifices would be made to Him there. I don't really know what to make of that exactly. Perhaps you do. But I think one thing we see is that in this interaction with David that day, and in the temple of God in general, we see just how badly God seeks a relationship with His people, with me and with you. And you know, before David even offered that sacrifice that day, the text says that the Lord had already relented from the calamity. He'd already said to the angel who was bringing the judgment, "It is enough. Now stay your hand." I just think we serve a God of infinite mercy and infinite grace who wants to be with me and He wants to be with you if we'll just let Him. So as Paul did to the Romans, I share his appeal to you and to myself today. By the mercies of God, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. Why? Because of what Paul said. Everyone who believes in him, in Jesus, will not be put to shame. And everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Don't waste your life here. Don't waste your time. This is what we were called to be. This is what we need to be using our life for. Making living sacrifices to the one who sacrificed everything for us. If we can help you in any way, know Jesus or come to Jesus, come forward now as we sing this song of invitation.